begin a new message series today in the book of Ecclesiastes. How many of you have ever read an Ernest Hemingway novel? Come on, a few of you, surely. Ernest Hemingway was born in 1899, and he was kind of the epitome of the 20th century man. He just did it all, from sipping champagne in Paris after World War I, his African game hunts, hunting grizzly bears and catching all manner of things from the sea, wrote a book called The Old Man and the Sea. He had it all. He had wine, lots of that, lots of women, lots of song. He was a distinguished literary, he had a distinguished literary career. He wrote about Sunday afternoons at the bullfights in Spain. He wrote a book, I think one of his first ones, called The Sun Also Rises. That title comes from the first chapter of Ecclesiastes. And he saw his own life in the same way that this author saw his life in terms of being meaningless. The age of 61, Hemingway took his own life. Now, he had been in a couple of airplane crashes and was busted up pretty bad, and he was in a lot of pain. But he left a note before he stuck a shotgun under his chin and pulled the trigger. He left a note that says, "Life is just one blankety-blank thing after another." And that was his take after all that he had done in this life and all that he had accomplished. It's just one thing after another. Ecclesiastes says that this is what it's like seeking after ultimate meaning through pleasure. The scripture wants us to wake up to the fact that, you know, that seeking pleasure with no seeking meaning through pleasure, is pointless. Before we wake up one day and find ourselves too old and it's too late to realize that our lives have no meaning and have no fulfillment to them. The Bible has wisdom literature, and Ecclesiastes sits among wisdom literature. The Proverbs are before it and the Psalms before that. There's the Song of Solomon, there's the book of Job. And these are all what are called the wisdom literature. And it's one of the reasons that I find the Bible so compelling. Because in the law, it's the voice of God. And it's pretty heavy. And it's kind of scary in some places. In the prophets, the voice is the voice of God coming through the prophets, speaking to the kings, speaking to us. And it's very incisive. It's like a razor blade. It's cutting. And it's talking about God's coming wrath against sin. It's also talking about God's comfort, but it's coming from somewhere else. But the wisdom literature is the voice of a human being speaking to me and speaking to you. And it's somebody talking to us, and we're both sitting in the presence of God, the writer of Ecclesiastes, and me, and you. We're sitting in the presence of God. He acknowledges the presence of God, but he talks about the realities of human existence in a way that makes sense to me. Ecclesiastes has a lot of themes that go back to creation, where the author is wandering and wondering about how things could have been, should have been, might be, could be. If you look in the first chapter, you see it here. Look, Verse 4 of the first chapter, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and also the sun sets, which is where the title of that book came from, and hurries back to where it rises. The winds blow to the south and turns, the wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, and there they return again. All things are wearisome. More than one can say, the eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. So the themes of the wisdom literature go back to, what was God's intention? Why did he make it all this way? Why are we in this place? One writer has said that wisdom is the all-pervasive presence of God that permeates the physical universe and the human social order. God's all around us. And that point is made in the Proverbs very clearly, where wisdom is personified as a lady, a woman. And it says, get wisdom from God, as it were. It's God's communicative work written in nature and human experience. And so we come to this book and we're a little unsure of who's talking to us. Turn, if you would, I hope you're at the book of Ecclesiastes, because I want to move around in here just a little bit as we get started and think about who's talking and what's being said. If you'll notice that in Ecclesiastes, there's a beginning and an ending. There's a prologue and an epilogue to the book that are a little different than the rest of the center of the book. The beginning of it says, the first verse of the book says, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, the perspective there is he's talking about the author or the speaker in the middle of the book in third person. So somebody else is telling us, it's an introduction. And now this person's going to talk to us. And they began in verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So the book begins that way. And then where our passage picks up in verse 12, it says, I, the teacher, was king over Israel. So it switches to first person. So we've got an introduction by maybe somebody else or someone backing away and talking about himself in third person. Then look at the very end of the book. Chapter 12. Verse 8. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Verse 9, not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. So, again, the epilogue is backing away. It's talking about whoever was telling us this story. So, we're not really sure. It's traditionally been assigned the authorship to Solomon, and all the scholars that I've looked at, and most of them people who honor this book as the Word of God, they're all over the place on this. And they're all smarter than me, so I'm not going to tell you who wrote it today. Because I think the author didn't want to make it real clear himself. Now he says he's the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Well, that could be Solomon. And then he says in verse 12, I was king over Israel and Jerusalem. Now, at what point would any king over Israel say that I was king? He would say that perhaps when he was dead, but it might be somebody else talking in his place. He's resurrecting the character of Solomon. And he talks about, look at verse 16. I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. Well, for Solomon, that was only his dad, because his dad conquered the city. Do you think he would directly insult his dad that way? It sounds like he's a little further out. Not sure. But this is the collected wisdom coming out of the tradition of Solomon. And so he is called here in this translation the teacher. Some have him as the preacher. The word in Hebrew means the gatherer, the assembler. The word is Kohelet. It's also is the name of the book. Ecclesiastes is just the Latin version of that. And that's a partial reference also to King Solomon, because in 1 Kings chapter 8, where the temple that Solomon has built is being dedicated, it says over and over again that Solomon gathered the people together. So he is a gatherer. So it's kind of a veiled reference to Solomon, but the perspective, it's a little hard to keep in focus exactly who it is that might be speaking to us. But that does not, all that set aside, this is a very powerful expression of what it means to be a human being in God's universe. Now, the other thing that we have to sort of establish at the beginning of studying a book like this is, what does he mean by meaningless? If everything is meaningless, why should we continue? Let's just all go home. I think part of the problem there, I'm not saying that meaningless is wrong, but I think meaningless may not catch all of what is intended here. Some of you, I think NASB has vanity, all is vanity. And that's not too bad. But there are a couple of things that would kind of fill in this meaning for us. The Hebrew word here, chevel, it captures a couple of ideas. One is that all things are transitory. They are fleeting. If you've ever bought a car, you know that it's worth less by the time you drive it off the lot than it was when you were looking at it. Its value is a fleeting thing. All things in life are fleeting. They're all temporary. This is one of the frustrating things about life, is by the time I figure it out, I'm probably too old to do very much about it. That's always been the difficult part of life. And so the writer here knows this. It's transitory, it's fleeting, it is elusive, it's hard to get hold of, it's fast, it runs away. And yet, there's something about it. It's out of our grasp, and yet it's lovely, it's wonderful, and it works. But I can't quite get my arms around it, and I never will in this life. That's what goes into the meaning of chevel. Meaningless. It's crazy. I can't get hold of it. So the world is comprehensible. That is to say, I know that the sun's coming up tomorrow. I'm quite certain of it. The tides are coming in and going out. I know the moon will rise. It's comprehensible, but it is not entirely comprehensible by us. So I'm not really a postmodernist in the sense that I think there's no truth out there, that, you know, one thing is your truth and one thing is mine. I think there is truth. I'm just a little in doubt about my ability to get my arms all the way around what things really are. And the problem with life is that, and you know, our Kohelet brings it up here, is that the more I learn about life, the less I actually know about it. I'm really certain of just about everything when I'm 20, and then now that I'm 60, I'm not sure I know so much anymore. And I've forgotten now more than I knew then. Life is just like that. And so I feel a little bit like one of our friends in the animal kingdom. I wish my life was this simple. I wish I was just thinking, huh, isn't it lunchtime? Or whatever it is he's thinking. Or she, I don't know. Life grows wearisome. We get tired of people who do not know what they're talking about, quite obviously, but who are very certain of what they're saying. Why is it that arrogance comes with ignorance in such a toxic blend? part of our life as human beings. What's out of our control in life? Well, death is out of our control. Death happens to everybody, and we all know it. Now, I don't think this guy worries about it much. That's one of the great things about being having a brain that size. What's for lunch? That's all I want to know. But we who are created in the Creator's image, oi, oi, oi. And if we haven't thought about death for a while, that's okay, but what happens the next time I think about death is that I realize I'm closer to it than I was last time I thought about it. Oh man, pretty soon I'm getting all wrapped around the axle. The other thing that we really have no control over is time. The clock keeps ticking. I can't get a time out to stop and think about this thing without my situation changing. How do I learn how to raise my kids when they're running around screaming all around my feet? I have to have figured it out, or I have to figure it out then. So death and time, and they're very much related, are out of our control. But we humans, we Americans especially, we in the West, I'll widen it out a little bit, we like to create our own meaning. We are autonomous beings now, and if you sign up for Facebook, I'm told, nowadays, you get a whole, I think, 15 or 18 or 20 choices on what your gender is. I mean, it's beyond, you know, L and B and T and Q and G. We get to be who we want to be, right? We get to pick our political party. We get to pick just about everything. How we dress, how we appear to the world, how we sell ourselves. You get to create your own meaning. Unfortunately, we are fenced in by a few things. What are we fenced in by? We're fenced in, as I mentioned, by time. We're running out of it the whole time we're rolling along here. We can't change time. We're fenced in by space. How many places can you be at one time? Still just one. And this is how time and space are related. If I need to get from this place to another place, what does it take? Time. That's the first questions we teach our children in arithmetic class. We teach them time and distance problems, because time is, or distance is time. If I want to get to somewhere else in the universe, it's light years away. I'm fenced in by those things. I can't change that. I'm fenced in by myself. I wish that I were thus and such an athlete, and thus and such a scholar. I wish that I were this. I wish that I were that. We all wish for those things. But here we are. You and me. We is who we is. And after a while, we sort of, hopefully, accept that. Hopefully, we come to the place where we say, God has made me thus. And so I will not spend my days working on things and wishing for things that cannot be and will not be. But I will operate in the strength that the Lord gives me. And I will trust Him with the weaknesses I have. I will belong to a community in which there are people who are strong in the way that I am weak, so that we can all function together as His people. That's a hard place to come to. It's not easy. Well, this book of Ecclesiastes, it's been around for 3,000 years or so.